When it comes to pricing enterprise software, it is common for technology companies to charge for their software on a per-user basis. But what if the number of users within your customer base starts declining? That hasn't really been a problem until now. I'm Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today I will be talking to Dan Belkowski, founder of Product Tranquility and an expert on pricing software. We will be discussing how long-standing enterprise software models are being upended. So let's get the insight engine humming. Welcome, Dan. It's great to see you. And I'm going to start out here with an easy one. How long has Product Tranquility been around, and what was the catalyst for starting the firm?
Great to be here, Thomas. I'm very excited for this conversation. I started Product Tranquility just actually passed about my 5-year anniversary last month. So pretty excited for that.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And entire career I've been in tech, started out more on the builder side and engineering, realized very quickly that I was much more interested in how the code we were writing actually created value for customers and dollars and cents for the business. So migrated into the management side and then into product management post-business school, got thrown into my first sort of pricing project in the real world, actually during an internship during my business school tenure, and was working for a very successful Silicon Valley startup. And one of the questions on the CEO's desk was, should they do a freemium model? And so several different projects I looked at for them that summer, TLDR, we may get to it, may not, but I do not generally recommend freemium. I think it's a terrible idea for most B2B software companies.
I was going to ask if that was a B2B company. So it was a B2B company looking at freemium.
Yeah. Well, that was actually B2C, but I think it's pretty terrible for most B2C companies as well. But in general, yeah. So then I went on to the product management side. So I spent a lot of my time trying to figure out, you know, what would drive the most value for customers, and got dragged into a lot of pricing discussions, even though I wasn't directly responsible for those. But there was a lot of folks who were like, I'm supposed to do this pricing thing. I don't understand it either. You went to business school. Like, how do we do this? So we muddled through a lot of those. And I got to see a company I work for acquired a ton of companies. So I got to see a lot of early mistakes, both on the product side as well as on the pricing side of what to do, what not to do, what works, and why. And so went off my own after rising through the ranks of multiple product leadership companies, and realized, you know, when I went off my own, like, well, a lot of these companies are really struggling with pricing and packaging. So that's all I've been focused on for the last several years. And now I have the honor to help these companies try to, you know, hit to profitability as soon as possible, as their, you know, boards and investors are kind of cracking the whip to do so. Yep. And a lot of them haven't really put the rigor into thinking about it. And hopefully, you know, this conversation will help.
You know, as I listen to you right there, I'm just super curious, because you do work with multiple companies on pricing. And what is the profile of the person who is responsible for pricing when you're working with these companies? Because what you just said, hey, I was on the product engineering side, and I sort of backed into this, and I realized I had a skill here, right? And you had intellectual, you know, interest and curiosity, and it took you on that path. But are these, like, typically marketing people? Are they finance people? I mean, who are you typically working with on pricing?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a thorn in my side. You know, as a small business owner, you know, you want to get real focused on who's your ICP and persona.
Yeah.
And tragically, it's not consistently owned in B2B software companies.
Well, that was my gut. Yeah.
My general recommendation is product marketing should own it, but I'll get approached directly by founder, CEO, chief revenue officer, chief marketing officer, chief product officer. Actually, rarely finance. They're a key stakeholder, but they're rarely the one who's sort of driving the change. You know, it's one of these things that is a decision, much like positioning. You know, the CMO ostensibly owns the positioning in the company, but they can't really go into their marketing offsite and create a new positioning for the company and spring it on everyone. It's not going to see the light of day. Pricing and packaging is very similar. And so, you know, it usually requires a CEO level, you know, involvement, because it's going to affect everyone at the executive table. But as you scale, I highly recommend, you know, two things off the bat. Define someone that's not the CEO who owns it in the company, because that usually that's a implicit decision, and then sort of is one of these things that no one feels like they own, and therefore it gets you know, ignored, or, you know, when there's a problem, everyone kind of looks at each other and nothing happens.
Who owns this?
So making an explicit decision, I think, is one important thing, and I think generally product marketing is generally the best suited to put it in most B2B software companies.
And when these companies approach you, whether it's a CRO, CMO, product marketing folks, and they're saying, hey, we need help with pricing, what type of services does your firm provide to help them? You know, how do you engage with them, just so I understand?
Yeah, well, so your folks come to us for, usually there's some sort of structural break that's happened. Mm-hmm. What I see a lot is, hey, we've grown beyond our initial customer segment, and now we're trying to sell into a new kind of customer, and the way we've priced and packaged doesn't align with the way that these folks see value. Or very commonly, as companies scale to a point where they become multi-product, this becomes a big challenge. One, it sort of forces, you know, they're maybe at a level of maturity by that stage where they're like, we kind of just been guessing at it, and now we're at a scale where maybe we should be a little bit more rigorous, mm-hmm. but also you're increasing the complexity. And so I'll often see this, especially when companies have maybe acquired a couple of other firms, and there's this sense often that, hey, we just paid a bunch of money for this company. We're not really 100% sure how it works. We don't want to change the pricing and packaging because we don't want to break it. I think that's a mistake. We could have a whole conversation about that. Because what ends up happening is that shiny object kind of just fades into the background, especially if you're doing multiple acquisitions. And then what you've done is accumulated all this organizational debt, because mm-hmm. now as your sales go-to-market teams are talking to customers, they're trying, you had this thesis on the acquisition, hey, we'll drive upsell, we'll drive cross-sell, but you know, the pricing and packaging models don't all align. Different. And so it makes the customer's head spin. It makes the sales head spin. And what you then find is that certain salespeople maybe know how to sell one product, and so they avoid bringing up the others, and then vice versa. And so you don't end up getting those synergies because the pricing and packaging models don't align. So we work with companies to really help them refine as they're at that stage. Like, okay, who is your target customer segment? Where are you best suited to play and win? You know, what is your positioning to demonstrate your differentiated value? A lot of value articulation. I deal with helping increase the amount of value literacy in the world often, because value and price are fundamentally linked in my world. And then working through all the different elements of packaging, like your pricing metric, your different offers, configurations, your pricing models, et cetera, to figure out, you know, how we're actually going to go win that market opportunity.
Perfect. So, and if I just play that back, I mean, two big use cases for you is, again, if a company has a structural shift, either they're maturing or they just are going after a different buyer, pricing may have to change. What should the new pricing look like? And then the other one I heard there is this rationalization of pricing models. Is companies, as they acquire, they got a lot of different pricing models in play. Hey, you know, this is going to be confusing unless you really create a more commonality there. And so helping them really pick what the winning model is as they rationalize. So, okay, perfect. That makes sense. And, you know, the reason I invited you on Tectonic right now is that in a little bit here, we're going to kick off a research journey related to pricing on technology services. Services and product are super, you know, blended in a lot of these software companies. And, you know, I think that there is some pressure on historical pricing models for software companies for two reasons. Number one, you and I were talking just before we kicked off here, you know, a lot of these SaaS companies are under immense pressure to be more profitable. So pricing is a key lever there. And they're trying to rethink, you know, what am I giving away? What am I not giving away? Articulating value. And the other one is AI. And you and I may not see eye to eye on that. It's fine. But I'm already hearing from some of the software companies that are nervous that if AI is reducing headcount or flatlining headcount growth in their customers, if my model is a per user model in pricing, I suddenly am going to hit a wall on growth. And so do I need a different type of pricing model, whether it's consumption, whether it's value realization, you know, to go after? So the first question I see is, what is your perspective of the biggest challenges facing, let's just say, B2B software companies right now as they're looking at pricing?
Yeah. So I think you hit on it, you know, in there, which is this push to profitability. What happened during the 2020, 21, beginning of 22 ZERP period was the money was raining from the sky in all directions. We saw that in public stock valuations. We saw that in home asset prices. We continue to see that in now prices at the grocery store. We finally trickled down into the commodity layers, just not just at the asset layers. During that time, software had huge pull forward in demand because everyone was working from home
And so it became this no-brainer. And we saw Zoom shoot up to, I don't know, 150x revenue or whatever its valuation was. And a whole bunch of other companies followed suit. All of a sudden in 22, the government says, ah, we got to stop this free money party. We're going to have a serious problem with inflation, tightens up the reins. That starts formulating in the second half of 22. The second half of 22 is very interesting. And this is very important because I think a couple of things were going on that map to your question. So in June of 22 is when the belt tightening really started to happen. And you started to see the first set of massive layoffs in the tech sector, you know, starting in Q3, Q4. So what I was seeing from clients, prospects who were coming to my firm, they were already under pressure from that on a user-based model. They were, because what had happened inside of these companies was they were getting pressure to grow at all costs.
Right.
So it was build features, hire as many engineers as you can, hire as many product people as you can, buy as many ads as we can through Google and Facebook, and just accelerate. And so the whole idea was add value, add value, add value. These are going to be winner take all markets. We want to grab as much as we can. And very rarely in that period, that ZERP period, was serious pricing conversations about the new value you're introducing. And so when the belts started to tighten, those customers had added already a bunch of powerful features and automations that sowed the seeds of their own demise. Because now it's like, oh, I'm going to cut sales because, like, well, we're not going to make our targets. I need less people carrying bags for quota. So that's all happening, right? And people are starting to see their net revenue retention and their new business numbers go down at the beginning of Q3 22. What happens in basically end of Q3, beginning of Q4 22? ChatGPT. So AI, I think, has become a little bit of a scapegoat for a lot of these user-based companies to say, look what AI is doing to us. I think that there's some truth to it, but I remember being an employee of several different publicly traded companies at one point, and I remember listening to the earnings calls of those companies when they'd go out and, you know, the CFO, CEO would tell this story to Wall Street. And not that they were lying, but they had a very clean story that mapped, you know, to one sort of thing that was, oh, the exchange rate with China is really affecting our currency, you know. And and I think that's a little bit, I think we're getting AI washed with problems with software models right now. It's like a lot of the blame is shifting there. That's not to say that there's not real value. That's not to say that it maybe is accelerating that curve a little bit. But I think that there was a negligence around properly pricing to value and thinking that free money party was going to last forever and thinking these were truly winner-take-all markets. And now folks are realizing, like, oh, actually, that's not, maybe that's not the case. So,
and I'm going to agree with, you know, and I'm just going to augment a little bit. So we saw everything that you just articulated in our data as well. The slowdown from 2022, tech took a bunch of headcount out to adjust to that. This long before, you know, AI came on the table. So that train was already in motion. I think AI has been an ongoing accelerator to that train. And I can tell you for sure the use cases we look at when people deploy AI within it, you know, tech companies, they can flatline or take headcount out. And so I think it is making a problem that was already there worse. And I think it's not going away. I think AI has, I mean, we've really just sort of scratched the surface of companies really deploying this aggressively across their workflows. And I think as that happens, it's going to put even more pressure on this user-based growth. So, but I think you and I are simpatico that there's a lot of pressure on that traditional model, right? And I'll put it this way, there may be AI washing in the short term. In the long term, that's going to be a real issue, is our point of view on it.
We get aligned 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So based on that, you know, that challenge, what are the different types of pricing models you see software companies exploring, adopting? I mean, how are they dealing with this new reality?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And so, you know, I think that one maybe landscape will help kind of navigate this situation, because I think there's broadly two different kind of categories of companies that we could talk about here. So there's maybe what you might call as AI as a service or your foundation model companies. So this would be Anthropic, OpenAI, you know, Google with Gemini, Mistral. I guess you might call Llama, but they're not charging anything. So we'll leave them aside. They're kind of disrupting the whole economics of, yeah, of even that yeah. model. So it's an interesting play in my space. But so I think they're charging almost a utility model, right? So you can think of those companies as the AWS, right? I'm yep. charging you for bare bones,
for what you use,
storage and compute. And so I think that there's a select number of companies in that world. And then everyone else who we're talking about are these AI enabled applications that are consumers of those foundation models. So I think that's a helpful kind of explanation, because I think people kind of look at, oh, well, what's OpenAI or Anthropic doing? But that doesn't really map to, you know, the folks
what
who
Salesforce
are,
is doing yeah, or
exactly,
something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And Salesforce is a little bit weird because they've got their own, I think Einstein is their own foundation model. Yeah. So they're a little bit of a hybrid. They're kind of like talking about Amazon. You kind of got to talk about, you know, AWS versus the traditional commerce business. So, so leave Salesforce aside. But what is going on there, I think we're seeing kind of two different models emerging. So we're seeing, and how I would think about this again is, you know, are you improving existing value drivers for existing customers, or are you creating, you know, new value drivers for your existing customers? So, you know, there'd be a third, but I don't think it's as interesting, which is kind of new value drivers for new customers, because we see that. I think those are kind of the net new sort of start from scratch AI companies that are getting a lot of attention, but are still very small yet. So in the existing value drivers for existing customers, what we see is this the embedded functionality or enhancement type approach. So what does that mean? So let's use the example of a CRM. I'll use Pipedrive so we don't bring Salesforce back in the mix. But so if you're Pipedrive, and they actually have released some AI features where the AI capabilities are embedded in their tiers of good, better, best. And they're used to drive additional tier upgrade, like upsell across those packages. They are not sort of directly monetizing the AI capabilities. And I think, you know, it's important here to also take a step back, because I think one thing that is a big mistake that I see companies doing is, let's not make the mistake that our brethren in crypto Web3 all made, where they went out to the world and said, hey, you know that product you love? Well, we now have it with blockchain. And everyone had was like, what? What are you talking about? I don't understand. We run the risk of doing the same thing with AI. It was like, oh, now with AI. And I think a lot of the market is still, maybe they've heard of ChatGPT, maybe even some of them use ChatGPT.
But they're not sure what that means in terms
like,
of the value.
You know, So, you know, if you go out, you know, it's like most SaaS companies today, you know, is like if you were a marketer and you're like, I want to tell everyone we run on a Oracle database on the back end. Be like, nobody cares. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
And so I see a lot of companies doing that in their messaging, like, oh, now we have this AI feature, but then also kind of moving that into their pricing directly in terms of like trying to talk about tokens or credits, and it just gums up the whole works. So we think about these capabilities, right, in terms of like Pipedrive, what they're doing is they're creating. So let's say, hey, like I've got an account or an opportunity in my CRM. You know, the new capability allows me to summarize all the communication I've had with that customer before.
Yep. Okay, so it's value add, new feature.
Yep. You know, it's value add, but it's helping to accelerate the capabilities of the existing user, right? Yep. And so in that case, right, that's that you're just embedding, encapsulating that as a new value add in order to drive upsell. The other kind of model is, you know, what we might think of as like a platform extension pattern. So you're seeing this being used by companies like Microsoft with their Copilot, for example. So Microsoft Office 365. I don't know. I haven't looked at the pricing in the last few months, but you know, like for a base, it's like $10 a user, and then their Copilot to get AI capabilities across all of their Microsoft Office suite is like an additional $25 per user. So it's like 2.5 times to get those additional capabilities, because they believe that those are entirely new value drivers. Like Word, you could sit there and write it, but with this AI capability, like it will write it for you. It'll create your slide deck for you. And so they view that as an entirely new value driver using that pattern. Another company I think is really interesting that we're seeing in that platform extension pattern is a company like Intercom. Where so Intercom, they do a lot of things, but specifically related to customer support ticketing. So you think of your standard help desk agent software, right? They compete with the Zendesks of the world, et cetera. They charge on a per user model, right? And they have capabilities that, you know, much like the CRM space, that will help those agents respond to tickets faster. But they've also created an extension that is agentic. That is, hey, this module, that entirely new add-on, has a different outcome-based pricing model that we will charge you based upon how many cases this AI agent can close independent of having even a human in the loop.
Interesting.
Right. Yep. So that's a net new value driver that they've broken out separately and created a separate pricing model for. So those are a couple of the interesting ways that we're seeing folks adopt this.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And so I'm going to click into a couple of things you put on the table there. On the last thing you put on the table there about an outcome-oriented model, I mean, I can tell you, you know, outcome-based pricing is something that's been on the table with our community for many, many years. And very, very few technology companies do that. I mean, it is, absolutely, you know, it's a minority case, mainly because of the risk of being able to connect the dots, right? And really be able to connect, okay, my technology really got you that outcome, unless it's a scenario which you just described, which is, hey, I have direct line of sight. How many cases is my AI bot or whatever closing for you? We can track that. We have visibility to that. And let's build a pricing model around that. I think that's super powerful. And I think that there are a lot more instances or use cases like that that are going to emerge. And it is an escape valve, right, for some of these software companies to get out of a user-based pricing or whatever and say, look, you know, hey, let's drive or anchor around these outcomes. There's no denial you're getting value from those. And it's a win-win, right? You're getting the outcome. We could compensate for that. So I think that that is going to become something that is not common, but more common. The other, you know, examples you were putting on the table there, let me give you a scenario that has been very real for a lot of the TSI members as they build these AI capabilities. And a classic use case is in support services, where a company builds basically a small language model focused on, you know, their tech user support content. And they say, look, now a customer, instead of submitting a support ticket or whatever, can go against this new, you know, AI model, ask questions, get answers super fast. It's super powerful. And so they invested and built that capability, right? And then they said, we're going to charge customers for that. Like, let's go out and say, hey, you really want this new cool AI capability. And a lot of the customers came back and said, nah, I don't know if I want it, right? And so I'd be interested in your perspective on this, right, as the pricing guy. And so the fallback position is that a lot of the companies released that capability, ultimately, you know, said, I'll just give it to the customer for free. Why? Because what it did is it had a dramatic impact on their cost to serve those customers. So the ROI was not in charging the customer for the capability. The ROI ended up being in dramatically reducing support costs, right? So there still was a real ROI there. I'm curious your perspective on that. If you have one of your customers who's developed a capability, this sort of part of it is, I could charge for it, but what if the customer adopts the capability and it saves me a bunch of money serving them? What's your perspective on the path forward when you kind of have that life choice in front of you?
Yeah, well, certainly what we're seeing for the most tangible use cases with these capabilities that are out in the market today, and not, you know, we just got through HubSpot Inbound and Dreamforce, Benioff, et cetera, talking about agents in this
agents
world.
Everywhere.
I think
agents everywhere.
agents everywhere. And look, I mean, I get the vision. I don't see that happening in a year. 5 years, maybe. I use these tools every day, and there's still way too much, you might call it a Wizard of Oz happening, where there really needs to be a human in the loop to really make them effective. And when that happens, they can really be powerful. But I think we're very far away from, oh, they could just go be a standalone SDR or customer support agent. I think that's a nice vision, and the companies will work towards that, but we're not there yet. But I think what you're pointing to is that really right now, the most tangible use cases are on cost saving side. And so what I see is kind of two things happening. Your example could maybe fall on either side, depending upon what company specifically we're talking about. But I do see a lot of companies, even technology companies, who are internally adopting a lot of these AI capabilities their own cost savings.
Oh, that's what we're focused on. Yeah, those use cases.
Not even building it into products, but, you know, can I use Microsoft Copilot, you know, to make my coders, you know, GitHub Copilot rather, I guess, my Microsoft, to be more efficient at coding. I mean, I use ChatGPT to help me troubleshoot problems on my laptop time to time, right? So our IT folks can do jobs, you know, more efficiently and faster. And if I can search a whole database of knowledge bases and support chats, right, as a customer service agent, right, internally, even if I don't ship that to customers, I can solve that. I have seen very few examples of the type of, we built this capability internally, and if our customers adopt it, it will save us a bunch of time, that I could speak to directly. There's a lot of chatter right now around the internet. There's a company called Klarna that make a lot of noise about, they're completely rewriting platforms like Salesforce and Workday with AI tools and going to completely displace these companies.
I've heard of this. Yeah, I have. Yeah,
I meet those with a little bit of skepticism. I have no inside knowledge about what they're doing or not. But when companies say, hey, we built this internal version of a CRM and now we're going to try to sell it to our customers, those are examples successfully doing that are very few and far between. You usually find the cost of maintenance, et cetera, are quite limited. But yes, I generally do agree with your premise that a lot of the low-hanging fruit right now is on sort of cost optimization.
Operational efficiency,
And that's where, you know, and I'm not the first person who's noted this, I think some of the most successful enterprise use cases are in the customer support case, because it's already structured in a way, like if most companies will have level one, level two, level three support escalation paths. Level one is pretty much your brand new support rep, probably offshore, paid very little, just to answer questions that have been answered a bunch of times, but the person was too lazy to search the knowledge base for 10 seconds. And so AI is super good at deflecting all those questions. So I think we're seeing very rapid adoption there, because there's a corpus of knowledge that's already been written down by humans of how to solve that exact problem. And AI just has to frame that in a friendly way and give it back to the user. So I think that that's very much going on. And I think there's a lot of companies like Intercom, like Zendesk, I think just launched an agentic platform as well, that are making strides in that direction.
All right. So let me test, you know, sort of a straw man here with you and just get your reactions. And again, if we're chipping on new AI capabilities coming out, say for traditional software B2B companies, what am I doing with that in terms of pricing? So I have a new AI capability. One thing is, I could basically say, look, I'm just going to throw it in because if the customer uses this, it's saving me a lot of money. That's one option. Next option is what you were talking about earlier. It is enhancing my good, better, best pricing model. So I'm putting these AI capabilities in and saying, hey, that's why this is the difference between the basic and the premium model, is you're going to get some of these new capabilities, like you were describing, automatic summary of case information or whatever. So that's an option. And then the third option is, like you were describing, I've got a new AI capability, which is truly net new value, Microsoft Copilot, whatever, and I'm going to hang a price on that distinctly and have you pay for that, right? So does that hold water with you in terms of how companies are approaching it?
And what I'll also flag, so I think there's an underlying friction here, and you hinted at it in our introduction, in that, so let me point at two things. First is, one mistake I see a lot of companies make, and this mistake could be applied to any of those paradigms that you outlined, which is, hey, we have a user-based model, we're going to add this embedded capability, and we're going to add this floater of, okay, it's still per user, but then we also give you, with that single user, 2,000 tokens a month.
Okay.
Do not do that.
Like,
do not show your customers your underpants. They do not care about your underlying cost structure. It's like, because nobody knows what a token is, right? And again, this is why at the beginning of the conversation, I made this distinction between the AI foundation models, the Anthropics, the open AIs versus everyone else, because that's how those folks charge. Like, if you're using AWS and you're buying S3 storage, okay, how much gigabytes am I using? How many CPU cycles am I using, right? And like, I'm the engineer who's buying that service, but I don't turn around to my users and be like, well, I'm charging you per user plus how much gigabytes of data you're using on our servers. Like, I don't do that. Yeah. So let's not do that here either, because it adds a whole bunch of sand in your go-to-market engine. And I see a lot of companies who are very worried about that. And that leads into my second point. Right now, we are in a very unique phase transition. And I say that explicitly, like when we think about like ice to water, right? There's a moment where ice is, it's not quite ice, it's not quite water, but like the water's at 32 degrees, but shouldn't it be ice at 32?
Yeah.
Sorry for our Celsius speaking friends in the rest of the world. The problem is that the value is still quite undefined, but the cost is highly defined. The CFOs are seeing that bill come in. CFOs and COOs are seeing that bill come in from these foundation models being like, oh my God, let's look
at that. That's real. That's real.
That's real. So let's recoup that, or let's make sure it doesn't get out of control. And so I think it's causing a lot of these uncomfortable conversations. I think we have to be comfortable as an industry working through, we don't quite know what the value is going to be yet. I think there's a lot of interest, but I think the use cases and the paradigms of usage patterns aren't known. And I think as CEOs, CFOs, we have to look at this as we're making an infrastructure bet on the future and taking a hit on that margin for the next 6, 12, 18 months until we have provable value. Or just if you think, if you are convinced that, hey, what we're adding in like that embedded model, like I mentioned with Pipedrive, is adding value, well, increase the per user price. But don't also then add in this floating credit thing that then everyone has to also understand. Like, hey, we added this capability and we think it's worth more. So we're going to increase our price across the board. And some people may use more and some people use less, but we think over, you know, net, both parties win.
Let me react to that because that's really interesting framing. And if I play it back, what you're saying is, look, for these, again, B2B software companies, you are starting to embed new AI capabilities into your value proposition, into what your software can do. You get a bill for that right now, for sure, because you're paying, you know, per token or whatever, you're paying to embed that capability. And yet it may still be unclear what the exact value proposition of that is and where you can explicitly charge the uplift or not. And so there is this uncomfortable transition period we're in, right, where companies are trying to figure that out. Now, and I think what you're saying is, when you get clear line of sight to, oh, bing, there's the value proposition because we now have this AI capability that I can defend that value, I can go for a higher price point, that's great. You should obviously do that. But there may be this uncomfortable time where that's not yet clear. You're picking up a bill that you can't yet, in a sense, clearly monetize with the customer. And I also think what I heard you say is, don't try to monetize that by saying, oh, I'm going to pass that bill on to you, customer, i.e. here's the token price, you know, if you, I think that's what you said, right? Just don't kind of pass that on because you're kind of like trying to do a pass through on your infrastructure costs. And the customer's going to be like, and I think you use the term, don't show them your underpants. Like, well, I don't care about your infrastructure costs. Is that
customers
get
don't
all
care
right?
about your costs? Yeah, customers don't care about your costs. And like, look, I mean, a lot of this goes back to, you know, the customers, like maybe they understand the value and maybe they even agree in principle. But what you find is that, you know, especially with the state of the technology, it's like, well, I don't know how many times I'm going to have to ask for that summarization before it actually summarizes it correctly, right? It's like, I'm going to have to go back and iterate. Like I use ChatGPT.
And if you're making me pay it all the time.
It's like, well, I just don't know, right? Because it's new for me. And so I can't even say, you know, it's not something I count in my environment today. So this is generally lumped this whole conversation underneath what I call a pricing metric. So pricing metric is the unit of value you charge for, can be, you know, user, could be gigabytes of data, could be API calls. We generally want to align that to something that they're counting today. Right. So seats is good because in a sales conversation,
super clear.
I'd be like, hey, like how many sales folks you got? Oh, I got 100. Great. It's $10 a seat. Like, you know, I see companies do this a lot and there's reasons, you know, there's more nuanced reasons for this, but it'd be like, how many automations or how many reports, customer reports are you going to create a month? Be like, I don't know. I don't have a CRM today. How many customer reports do most people create a month? Like, I have no way to base that in my environment today until I start using your system. And so you're putting your salespeople in a very difficult position to just extend sales cycles. Cause then what you have to do is they have to go through like a limited POC and then we're going to try to extrapolate that. And, you know, then those estimates are going to be wrong. That's going to create uncomfortable conversations in 6 months when they exceed their limit that they bought. Yeah. And you're going to have to, you know, be like, well, you told us X and you know, we are using Y, but we didn't know. You don't want to be in that conversation 6 months after they purchased.
Yep. So if I play that back, a really important nugget you put on the table is whatever your pricing model is, you want to anchor it on something that your customer counts right now and they understand what that number should be. So again, whether it's users, whether it's whatever, even if it was the expense reporting type tools where they say, hey, we're going to charge you per expense report. If it's something where they're like, yeah, we typically generate 100 expense reports a month, I have clear line of sight to that, then that's going to be okay. If they're like, hey, I have no idea, like you said, how many custom reports I'm going to do around a CRM, that's not the best anchor coming out of the gate. Is that?
Yeah, yep. Correct. Correct. Yeah. Perfect. Or, you know, if you have DocuSign, how many contracts are you guys, you know, running a month? Right? Like your legal team knows the answer.
So that, again, I think that's an important nugget. I want to chip a little bit more on this per user pricing versus any other mechanism. I don't care what the other mechanism could be. But again, this nervousness that enterprise software companies were very used to being able to count on employee growth, you know, with their successful customers, that was just a gimme, right? Again, if you're selling a CRM and you're selling to sales organizations, when you're selling to growing SaaS companies, you always have more salespeople. But if that really remains under pressure for the various reasons, whether it's the economic pressures, whether it's, you know, again, the focus on profitability, whether it's the impact of AI, what is the escape valve there? Is there anything that you see how the pricing models for B2B, you know, software companies are going to have to evolve?
It's a great point. So I haven't seen super recent data on this, but the last time I looked, seat user-based pricing, I think, was floating around 40% of B2B software companies. So it's not the majority, which may be a surprise to folks, but it's still significant. It's probably the most popular.
It's probably the most common. Yeah, so 40% is still the most common. Do you remember what the next one was?
I do not. Okay. You know, there's a bunch we could kind of talk through, but I don't remember the rank order.
Well, give me an example. I'm sorry to interrupt, but if it's not seat-based, what are some examples of the other things, you know, regardless of rank order, that they would go to?
Yeah. So I used to be in the IT operations management space. And so you might look at like number of endpoints that are monitored the number of sites that the product is used on or the number of locations the customer has. So say you're selling to franchise businesses, right? And it's like, oh, I want to, somebody owns 50 Burger Kings, right? I want to price them different than the guy who owns 2 Burger Kings, right? Yep. So how many retail locations do you have?
Got it. Got it.
So those would be different types of metrics, right? Or how many documents, you know, you're signing via, you know, an e-signing platform. Yep. But per user, like I said, it's not the majority, but it's the highest. I am not a person who says that user-based pricing is dead. It's never applicable. I think there's very good situations where it does work oftentimes where, you know, we've been using the CRM market and as an example, and that's one of the places where it does highly correlate to revenue. There's two different terms I use. So there's value metrics and price metrics. A value metric is how a customer will judge the effectiveness of your product. Are you helping them save money? Are you helping them make money? Are you helping them reduce risk? So there's going to be, you know, some sort of value metric, and then you're looking for pricing metrics. These are things that you can count because maybe you can't do revenue unless you're Stripe and you're in the transaction, and then that's a perfect model, right? This would be an example where outcome-based pricing works, but I agree, also one of the very few. But you want to try to find pricing metrics that correlate with that value metric. So to CRM, what's the value? Hey, we're going to help make your sales guys more efficient. They're going to close more deals because of that. They're going to close higher deals, right? They're going to be able to move sales cycles faster. Yep. So it all rolls up to a revenue. And it tends that the number of sales folks correlates very well with revenue. And therefore, it works out well. Also, it really helps because there's very little incentive to disintermediate your pricing metric because, you know, it's like you're not going to have all your salespeople, 100 salespeople share the same Salesforce account because no one's going to be able to figure out what's going on, right? Everyone's assigned the same accounts and you just have to guess, like it's not going to work. So that actually works out pretty well. In this scenario where, you know, you're under pressure, one of the key sort of metrics I'd be looking at, first of all, is this idea of net revenue retention. So I've got gross retention. So how many logos kind of overall, I start out with 100 customers, I end up with 80. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got 80% retention, 20% churn on an annual basis. But some of those users may have expanded or contracted, right? And so this is, I think, what you're pointing to with this pressure on users is that, you know, hey, you want to generally tie that to a number that's growing. That'd be good principled advice, right?
Right.
Amount of data is going up every year. Let's tie it to data, right? So I think the question is like, does that still correlate to value? Are what you're experiencing sort of a temporary reduction? Or is this something more existential? Like we've tied our metric to something that's going to be going, you know, down in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Then the question is, okay, if we think that we've added more value for those existing users, I can increase my price. Or we can take the more dramatic step of completely
reevaluating our pricing metric. And so I've had a whole webinar of 60 minutes talking about how to create a good pricing metric. But you know, in general, you know, we want to align with the customer's perceived value, align with your costs, and minimize operational friction. So both sides can exert some amount of reasonable control over that metric. So for a lot of companies, it may be time for them to have a serious view of what is the appropriate price metric given the value that they had. Maybe they chose, you know, users out of historical inertia before or momentum. And so now it's time for them to evaluate. But the way you would go through that process is, this is hinting back at my beginning of the conversation, working through value literacy. I work a lot with clients up front to like help them very much articulate what is the value that customers are expecting to get out of your product, and then working backwards from that. So I think the biggest mistake that companies make is, well, users isn't working, so let me go look in the product database and see what other fields we could possibly count. And I just think that that is a recipe for sadness. Instead, start with the customer and the value and work backwards. And out of that process comes metrics that you can count that correlate to the what the customer's getting from the value they're getting from the product. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so let me make an observation on that. Give a scenario for the listeners here. Let's say that, again, your CRM's easy. You used to sell per user, per salesperson. And what you're finding is the number of salespeople is flatlining or declining, but revenue for that company continues to grow. So you want to anchor yourself in some way on growing revenue as opposed to headcount.
Correct. Yeah. And traditionally, those have gone in line, right? You see companies that are generating more revenue generally have more sales folks, and they have more quota carrying reps. I mean, that's one nice thing about salespeople is that they carry a bag. And so they have a number assigned to them in terms of revenue. And so,
well, I agree with that. But I guess what I'm pushing on is the fact that my working premise right now is that the revenue per rep, you know, how much revenue they're taking down is going to go up. So things are getting decoupled here. So it used to be, you know, revenue grew and reps grew at a certain correlation or relationship very closely aligned there. Now, I think what you were going to see, it's already happening, is revenue is going to keep growing for, you know, successful companies. And yes, will the number of salespeople grow, but at a much slower rate. So again, if you're a software company serving them, you want to be on the curve that's growing the fastest, right? You want to be aligned to that. So again, if you're a CRM provider, can you come back with your pricing model and say, hey, it's really about revenue under management. As that thing is growing, our pricing is going to be aligned to that because we're helping you efficiently, effectively take that revenue down. And so we're going to figure out a pricing model that is aligned to that curve and not simply the number of salespeople using the system.
We're 100% agreement. So where that revenue curve is the value metric. And what you're pointing to is that correlation I was talking about between the pricing metric and the value metric is maybe losing strength compared to where it was in the past.
Exactly.
Because there's other factors that are impacting that. So I think that's 100% valid. I will say, when it comes to this decision, there's a bunch of different tools we have on the table to try to tackle this. One thing I would kind of lay out as a distinction is, I want to be very careful for folks who are maybe in a high volume and velocity go-to-market model. So say ACVs less than 50K versus those above 50K. For those who are less than 50K, in general, I would be very adamant you do not try to add in an additional pricing metric, because that's usually what people pull for. It's like, hey, we charged on users before, and now we're also going to add on something else, like the amount of opportunities you have in your database or something additional. Why is that? Because I'm a math nerd. We don't need to get into that. But even if you like math, it's like, if I say, okay, it's $10 a user, how many users you have? Like, oh, that's easy. Like, it's $1,000 a month. But if I now say it's 100 users at $10 a month and something else, just that mental, you now have to break out the spreadsheets. So in a fast go-to-market model where you're expecting your sales folks to be closing 1, 2, 3 deals a week,
you don't want any friction.
You do not want any friction. And that adds a massive amount of friction. And that's one of these areas where, like, oh, and then there's this credit thing. Really, I mean, that's really bad. Like, that's an extreme example. That's the first place people go. If you have maybe a more enterprise go-to-market motion, you have some other opportunities. you can add other parts of the pricing structure that, for example, hey, there's a base platform fee that changes as a percent of revenue. So we're layering on a user count on top of a base platform fee that changes as the companies are larger, or, you know, and there's any number of ways that you could sort of structure that. But those are ways that you can additionally get at these sort of nuances that you're pointing to, where the strength of just one metric doesn't sort of cover everything. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most important decisions for pricing. Like, everyone thinks that what you charge determines your success. In fact, how you charge determines your success.
Yeah.
And there's rarely a single pricing metric that works perfectly for all your customers in the first place. So I think you're pointing to is, you know, there's this underlying current where this is always a difficult decision. And so what we're experiencing now is a sort of an industry-wide shift where maybe some of this more traditional thought around how well that correlated to the value metric is also kind of disentangling more than some people prefer, and requiring us to go back and take another look at it.
You said something, again, really important nugget there, which is what's going to determine your ultimate success here is not explicitly what you charge, but how you charge. And I think what we're chipping on here today is that how B2B software companies charge is going to be evolving here, right? That models that we were very comfortable with for decades, right? You know, straightforward user, you know, user base, good, better, best, is getting more nuanced. And especially if the user number is getting decoupled from the growth numbers, you know, within the customer. So I think it's really interesting times. And I'm watching the clock. I just want to ask you one more question. So, you know, one of the use cases for AI that we've seen in one of our member companies, Dell, submitted what we call StarWard, an application on best practices applying AI for rev gen purposes. The StarWard application, they outlined the use case where they are using AI models to help them determine discounting related to their maintenance contracts, right? So a customer comes up for a renewal, you got to price it, you got to figure out what you're going to charge. And they're starting to feed that data. Of course, they have a lot of, you know, big N here, a lot of customers, into an AI model that comes back with the recommendation, right? In terms of, hey, this is what the discount rate makes sense for this particular customer with their size and what they have in play and all this kind of fun stuff. And they are seeing improvements in both reduced discounting, you know, improved margins, and actually improved renewal rates, because the pricing is more in the strike zone of what the customer is going to accept. So it's a really interesting use case, right? Using big data, you know, machine learning models to really fine tune what pricing makes sense for a particular customer. Have you seen that start to play out anywhere else? Have you stumbled on this? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I left it out of my initial sort of breakdown of different AI topics as pertains to pricing, because I want to keep it simple. But when people sometimes want to talk about AI pricing, they mean this part, which is, how do I do things like dynamic pricing, right? Where I've got, you know, and we've seen this for years in the airline industry, right?
For sure.
There was that old thing of like, oh, if you want the cheapest flight, buy it on a Tuesday. Like, why a Tuesday? Yeah. I don't know. because somebody wrote a COBOL program 30 years ago that updated all the prices on Tuesdays. Somehow we found that glitch. But there's been companies in the dynamic pricing world on the B2B side, much more so in the industrial goods world, like Pros, Zilliant, Price Effects. There's a couple others. Apologies if I can't remember them at the moment. But those companies have applied these. We talk about AI mostly meaning Gen AI, but there's, you know, traditional sort of machine learning models for decades at this point, right? Both in the airline industry, the hotel industry, as well as like industrial B2B, you know, 3M and Dell, I think is a good example. They generally do not work well for B2B software. I actually haven't seen them use them at all. Like, it's even a bit of a joke between me and a couple other pricing experts, who is like, you know, you see these people who sell the dynamic pricing software, they don't use their own software to price their software because it doesn't work for that kind of business.
They're more interesting.
Well, because, you know, you talked about Dell, right? Yeah, they've got a giant N, and you just usually do not have that scale of transactions in a B2B SaaS world in order to use those kind of econometric models. And observational data ages out very quickly. You need significant amounts of data to make that work. And look, this was one of the early mistakes I made in pricing. We were talking earlier about I was getting pulled into these pricing conversations as a product leader. And in business school, I had taken pricing classes where we had done a bunch of analysis where you're the brand manager of Minute Maid orange juice and you're looking at scanner data from all these grocery stores and are you on promotion? You know, which sizes sold the best? You know, did you have an end display rack that week? Right.
Right.
I mean, those models, I mean, and I have friends who are pricing experts who work with retail CPG companies, high transactions, and that's what they do all day, every day. They do a lot of that work. It just doesn't apply in my B2B software world for better or worse.
That's great. That's why I wanted to ask you that question in terms of what you were seeing, because it's the first I've seen it start to show up in enterprise technology companies. But you're making a very important point, which is, hey, if you're an enterprise technology company like Dell or somebody, and you've got massive transactions going on, you know, certain types of offers, that model's going to be a good model. If you're N is lower, if customers are much more bespoke in terms of, you know, the types of offers, that's a hard way to go. And so, it just doesn't make sense. So yeah, super helpful. Well, hey, Dan, I really appreciated the conversation. We, you know, took, you know, twists and turns there, but the main thing I want to do for our audience is to get this conversation in play, because I think where you and I are very simpatico is that the pricing models for B2B enterprise software companies, they are going to be changing over the next couple of years. And I think that people have to really lean in and probably get way more sophisticated in like things you're putting on the table there. What are the value metrics? How do those align to the pricing metrics? It's not what you charge, it's how you charge. That building, you know, really good thinking there is going to be critical to keep margin on the table for these companies, right? So it's going to be interesting time over the next couple of years. I think you're going to be a very busy person. So let me end with the question of the day for the audience. And that is, when you look at your pricing approach, is the pricing model for your software future-proofed for the impact of the trends that are unfolding in our world today? Cheers, everybody.